Good evening. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for coming. This is City Horizons event. It's a series of events that we've been running now for, I guess, about 2 years. And it's really an opportunity for us to bring the best minds together to share with us their thinking about our cities, not only our cities today, but in some instances where our cities have been and indeed where our cities are going, to ask some of the and explore some of the big questions. So you're not necessarily going to get very policy-specific prescriptions on what we should be doing about X or Y. I think our speakers are challenged with thinking about some of the bigger issues that are affecting not only UK cities, but actually cities across the globe, whether they're in the developed or the developing, the emerged or the emerging countries. So it's the big issues that we're primarily interested in addressing and thinking about in our Horizons event. And tonight we have a fantastic speaker who's going to share his thoughts with us. He'll be known to many of you, Professor Michael Stauffer. Michael is a professor of economic geography, not just in one place or in one city, but actually in three places and in three different cities. So he's an economic geographer in London, at the London School of Economics, in California or in Los Angeles at the University of California, and in Paris at Sciences Po. So in a sense, his background should perfectly set us up for an insight into these sorts of questions and issues. And as you can see, his question or issue is issue around separate worlds or shared prosperity. What does the economic performance tell us about those sorts of issues? But without further ado, Michael, the floor is yours.
So thank you all for coming, and as Andrew said, I want to raise a question about cities, but also about the broader picture of cities in a broader national or even global context, especially about what we might call systems of cities. So let me sort of give you a problem to think about here, which is cities versus the rest. And sort of the fact starting point for thinking in this way is that if we look at a key measure of prosperity of people, which is their per capita personal income, the interregional inequality in this indicator is growing in most of the developed countries, especially in most of the major countries of the European Union, including Britain and the USA. But also we have growing disparities in the rate and type of job creation and levels of productivity. So those are key economic indicators. And this is something that in economics and geography and urban studies, we now have a term for. We call it the Great Inversion. So the Great Inversion gives us a time perspective on this issue of divergent regional development, which is to say that if we look at the middle of the 20th century, the great post-war period, there was a tendency in most countries for prosperity to even out across different metropolitan areas, across regions, in what, you know, in economics we call that convergence. And indeed, it was at different levels. Prosperity was evening out between the great metropolitan areas, the lesser metropolitan areas, and, you know, various kinds of outlying regions or provinces or whatever you want to call them, but also in between the inner metropolitan areas and the outer metropolitan areas, where the focus of development in many countries was the suburbs or the outer metropolitan areas. But something changed, and it changed roughly starting in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and that's this inversion that I'm talking about, which is that since then, large metropolitan areas are the main focus of qualitatively good growth. That means good jobs with high incomes. And the other thing that's surprising is that, especially since the new millennium, inner metropolitan areas are favored in both the quantity and the quality of job creation over outer metropolitan areas. So things have inverted. Okay? So there are now, if we look at the world in 2017, there are these huge productivity and wage gaps between places that we were, at least when you were trained in economics like I was, we were not trained to believe would be here. We believe that the process of development is one of evening out, especially in developed countries, which have high capacities to invest in their cities and regions. We have good infrastructure, we have high levels of education, and so on. So this is also what we call, or what Enrico Moretti felicitously termed, the new geography of jobs. And we could say it's a new geography of not only jobs, but skills, opportunity, employment, productivity, per capita income. And there's a new geography of migration that I'll talk about. But also with this new geography of migration, there are these soft factors that are now starting to interest us, which is a new geography of diverging worlds of values, perceptions, and attitudes. So one sort of a provocative way to think about this is in the major developed countries, we are no longer unified societies in geographical terms, but we are increasingly separate worlds. And that's the case I want to make to you, and I want to lay out an agenda for thinking, understanding, and maybe correcting it. So I think this is a sign of the times, right? Here's a quote: regional inequality is proving too politically dangerous to ignore. From The Economist, December 2016. And this economic divergence that I'm going to refer to seems increasingly to map onto polarization of political attitudes and certainly of electoral choices, right? So Donald Trump, in America, the basic territorial unit is counties. There are 3,144 of them. The slide is incorrect. Hillary Clinton won 473 out of 3,144 counties. Donald Trump won 2,600 or so. And actually, they contain a minority of the population, but because of the American electoral system, you can win doing that. Brexit, of course, as we know, sharp, very sharp geographical splits in leave and remain preferences, roughly mapping onto the map of prosperity. And same thing in France. If you look at the first round elections and you look at where the president, Emmanuel Macron, won, a very sharp split between the Macronistas and the Le Penists. Okay, so these are now emerging, and we're seeing these maps emerge and be reproduced in many different ways. The Economist continues, and I think it's a kind of an interesting shot across the bow to we in the academic world, which is they say, orthodox economics has few answers to the problem of regional inequality. If economists cannot provide answers, populist insurgents will. So now we could think about what some of these so-called answers are that are coming from the people who represent, I think, certain kinds of protest votes and their regions, which is a kind of a new mixture of politics of hostility to globalization, the European Union, to trade, to immigration. And so in this way, the urban and regional question has become the root of some of the powerful politics that may end up shaping not just the future of localities, but the future of globalization itself. We're seeing that obviously play out in the future of the European Union with respect to Brexit, but also with the politics of the Trump movement with respect to global trade agreements, and many other things. So it's also the case that in many countries, electoral systems overrepresent non-urban areas. There's a kind of a typical upper house of many parliaments that is for historical reasons weighted toward urban areas. But what that means, whether we like it or not, is that these votes of dissatisfaction from these less prosperous areas can't be ignored, and I would also say they shouldn't be ignored. Now, why do we live in this world of divergence? In economic geography, we have actually a pretty decent beginning explanation of it, which is clustering or agglomeration economies. there was a very strong change in the focus of growth in modern capitalism that occurred roughly in the late 1970s and early 1980s. We used the moniker, the new economy, to try and capture that set of shocks. But basically what happened is we got the digital revolution, so that the focus of growth in manufacturing and services went from being mechanical to digital. It involved a huge lowering of long distance trade costs. There was also, because of the digital revolution and political decisions to liberalize capital markets, the growth of finance as a major part of the economy. That in turn is coupled to the rise of things like media industries, new forms of healthcare, and so on. You can sort of tell a story about the old economy and the new economy. And in the new economy, there are industries that are the focus of growth in the sense that they are highly innovative, they attract huge inflows of capital, right? You can see what companies are worth a lot of money today as opposed to the companies that were around in 1980. Right? And they're new economy companies that are worth a lot of money today, right? That's where the capital and capitalism flows to where the opportunities are. These are also the industries that produce huge quantities of new employment, mostly skilled employment, and so on. And this wave of technological change leading to changes in the output of the economy is ongoing. It's not over yet. So the digital revolution is in the middle of its course. Finance is still in a revolution. So is healthcare. So are media. So are many of these other industries. Now, what about these industries? What's their geography? The geography of them is that they transform the entire economy, but that their core functions are urban. They are located in urban places because they are the functions that invent, manage, and create the ongoing change, which is the creator of high prices, values, and skilled jobs. So these industries are overwhelmingly, in terms of their high value-added, high wage components, they're overwhelmingly urban, and they're surprisingly oriented toward big cities. Now that's surprising because big cities have lots of congestion, they have high housing costs. And these are the things that, of course, in economics we're told are inhibitors of employment creation. So something about the clustering or attraction effect is strong enough to overcome the disadvantages of major metropolitan areas. And this is something that we observe, but that frankly we didn't know would be so powerful. I'll come back to this. One preliminary answer as to why this wave of geographical concentration that's produced the Great Inversion and the new geography of jobs, one reason why it's so powerful is that it's not a one-off advantage to big cities. It's that these industries are learning machines. They're still, like I said, they're in the middle still of their revolutionary effects. They keep changing themselves through what we call learning, or you could call it innovation. And a lot of the learning and innovation they do happens in these big city clusters. So cities are regenerating, they're continuing to regenerate their advantages through this learning, this kind of feedback effect. And cities then generate networks, that is, networks of their feeder, so their supply structures. They generate networks in labor markets of all the skilled people who are churning in and out of these learning innovation systems. They generate networks with the research apparatuses, the think tanks, or whoever is involved in creating the knowledge that they need to sustain themselves and be innovative. And of course, there's a kind of a symbiosis between finance and the rest of the economy. Symbiosis, you know, you can like it or not like it, and there's a big debate about whether it's good or bad, but it's there. And so what happens is, if you add all this together, cities are still attracting talent in spite of their high costs, right, in a way that we didn't quite expect. So cities, in spite of high housing costs, and this is going to be an important element that we, that I think we want to develop here, in terms of, in spite of high congestion and in spite of increasing travel times, cities have generated actually more and more amenities that attract people, especially skilled ones. So in the context of becoming bigger, richer, and in some ways on the negative side, more congested and all those bad things, the thing that many cities have done is they've become a lot more pleasant, right? We've got more parks. We've got more kind of, you know, amenities for skilled people, in part because at the same time, many of the world's biggest cities have been emptied out of their manufacturing, right? Which was what made them polluted and kind of gray and gritty. So they've generated amenities, but they've also generated a residential economy. That means a lot of disposable income that induces a need for local services, that, you know, things like restaurants, right, and dry cleaners and all the other things that go into big cities today, that attracts not only the skilled, but attracts opportunity-seeking international migrants, right, people who come there and who can get into that residential economy. The skilled in most of the world's major big cities still have higher real income, that means when we adjust for housing costs, than those who have similar skills but who are not in major cities. So there's still some kind of measurable net benefit to being in London, to put it, you know, in that kind of local example. The other thing that's really, I think, but even deeper and a stronger reason for that people keep flooding into these, let's call them crowded, expensive, congested, but amenity-rich cities, is that people have higher lifetime earnings prospects in big cities than they do in other places. And that's simply because when they churn through these high turnover, very complex labor markets of cities, they pick up more and more skills, and you can measure it, which is that if you do an experiment and you put one person, you put two people with similar skills when they enter the labor market and they're in their 20s, and you see what the trajectory of earning is on average, what happens is that you suffer when you're young in places like London because your housing's expensive, but by around 35, you're doing better than your friend who located in a provincial city because you're learning more. So this is a measurable effect. Now, there's another thing that accompanies this big picture of urbanization today, which is, but it varies from country to country. So here I'm influenced by the American example, which is a great migration slowdown. So America, among the developed countries, always had really high levels of inter-regional migration. And we can measure that the historical average from 1880 to 1980 was that about 3 or 3.5% of Americans changed state per year. Since 1980, that level has been cut in half. So it seems to have collapsed durably. And in the new millennium, it's hovering around 1%, so at about a third of the long-term historical average. Not so much, as I understand it from my LSE colleagues, the collapse hasn't been quite as dramatic for Britain, and it has collapsed a bit for France. So now, let's think about migration. Historically, migration is one of those opportunity, we might say, spreading mechanisms in the sense that if you are someone who gets skills or is particularly ambitious and you don't live in a prosperous place, what you do is you migrate to where you can deploy those skills or learn or become more prosperous. So moving up to opportunity is a good image of a migration-rich economy. The other thing is, of course, jobs going out to people. We'll come back to that. But so if migration slows down, then what we should begin to think about is, are people able to move up to opportunity? And the answer seems to be that it's slower than it used to be, or there's less possibility of doing that, and we want to know why. In America, we know that it's not just a collapse in the overall level of migration, but that there's two different circuits. So the skilled are moving, but they're moving among skilled places. Or the image should be moving from New York to San Francisco, right? But not moving from New York to Texas or Texas to New York, right? That's a different category of place, except for Houston, which actually, I know it's in the news these days. Houston's a pretty prosperous place. The less skilled, by contrast, don't move much at all anymore. They're increasingly stuck, and we want to know why they're stuck. So that's a big issue. Now, there is a response. So this is now, we can tackle one of the great policy debates of our day, which is, why aren't people moving? And is this the kind of the deepest problem in the emerging geography of economic development that we have? So I would say that the mainstream view in urban and regional economics is that it's about housing. That housing markets are blocked by overregulation in prosperous metropolitan areas. So this is the world of prosperous, elitist, NIMBYs and big cities that are much decried on the media these days, right? So the image is, we're building the ramparts and pulling up the drawbridges because we're here and we don't want anyone else in. I say we because I'm one of these people living in these big cities, right? You actually have papers in America that are sort of like counterfactual scenarios, and they say, if it weren't for this NIMBY phenomenon, places like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, and Boston, and so on, would be much bigger than they are today, and they would welcome more of these unskilled, opportunity-seeking migrants from other places. And as a result, the world would be less divergent and less frustrating, because by allowing the migrants in, because they're blocked by these NIMBYs, right, that inter-regional income divergence would be lower, and the excluded would have more opportunity. And they describe the current situation as one in which the skilled who are in the cities, plus especially landowners, are the winners, right? Because they're able to jack up housing prices and extort higher rents from everybody, including the skilled. Now, there is clearly some truth to this point of view, right? The housing price gaps between less prosperous cities and regions and the prosperous ones in almost every developed country, except for Germany, where there seems to be a housing surplus. But the housing price differences are greater than ever. And so that's kind of a prima facie evidence that there probably is a barrier, that if you grow up somewhere and you want to get to London, it's harder in terms of getting access to the metropolitan London housing market than it was for your parents, okay? Now, so that there's some truth to it. The question is, how true is it? How big an explanation is it of the divergence? And does it lead us to the possibility of dealing with the divergence through housing policy alone? Some doubts we can have are, of course, that skilled natives and immigrants do move. And the immigrants are often not wealthy. They somehow manage to get into London. Right, so we're telling different stories, and we're saying somehow unskilled natives can't get to London or don't want to go to London, whereas international migrants, I guess they're willing to accept conditions, whatever they are, to get into London. But in any case, people are getting in. So for example, if I take San Francisco Bay Area, it's the most expensive housing market in America today, but it gained 550,000 people between 2010 and 2016 alone, in spite of having supposedly super highly regulated housing markets and NIMBYs everywhere. So somehow people are getting in. Probably they're getting in through unconventional housing arrangements like transforming legacy housing areas or crowding or various, maybe through substandard housing. There could be lots of ways that this is occurring. Now, so I think actually, though, that if I want to make an assessment of the general policy debate, there's an overemphasis on housing. I'll put my cards on the table. I think that the dominant perspective, I think it's true in Britain, I think it's true in America, is that the real problem that we have with the kind of glued up works of inter-regional divergence and access to opportunity is that we really got to deal with the housing problem And mostly we've got to deal with, you know, with deregulating housing and creating more fluidity and bringing the growth of housing prices down, and that'll solve our problems. I think it's placing too much weight on housing. And I think that's in part because the housing price gaps are really more the outcome of this new geography of jobs, this great inversion, which is that the good jobs are going places, so the incomes are there, so people are bidding up the cost of housing, and that's where the pressure comes from. A lot of it comes from this machine on the demand side, which is about jobs and incomes. It's not just the supply side, it's the demand side, it's just overwhelming. So housing policy will help on the margin, but it's not going to give us the paradise of divergence and opportunity for everyone. Now, why? Now let's take up this question of migration, because I think it's really at the kind of the core of a lot of the economics and also politics of the world of the kind of world of geography today. We know in the U.S. we have pretty good now hardcore results that show that this skill-based economy is driving migration to cities. Basically, people are going to where the demand for skills is, and the skills are heavily geographically concentrated. But what do we mean by skills? Well, skills in the new economy, we're learning, are not just getting a lot of university diplomas. There's clearly that. We are in a period where there is an emphasis on getting a graduate and postgraduate degrees and so on, and very specialized. But we're also learning from a lot of really good new economic research that informal skills in this hyper high-tech economy are more important than ever. Almost paradoxical, right? Where you think that we're in a world where it's all training and all this kind of hard knowledge you're supposed to get. Well, it turns out that experience matters, and it matters a lot. Being in certain places is a complement to your formal education. And, of course, if that's the case, then people who don't have access to being there, they may get good formal education, but there are increasing differences between, let's say you get the same diploma in City 1 and City 2. The person in City 2, if it's a prosperous networked metropolitan area, they have the experience skills that the person in the other city doesn't have, and as a result, that's because they've had the internships, they've gone to the networks, they've met the right people, they've circulated in and out of the firms, while the other person's been in the classroom. And so this is something we also didn't really anticipate in terms of the economics and geography of skills. So moving up to opportunity is blocked for less skilled people, especially for natives, but also even for the skilled who are educated in the wrong locations. So university, the implications of this are really dramatic, right? Which is that universities in outlying regions, like that's not politically correct terminology, but you know what I mean, they really have to do more than train formally. And by the way, I mean, I know this from being in the academic world, most of my colleagues, people I know who are deans and administrators and so on, they know this, right? This is now pretty widely admitted in universities everywhere, that it's not just what you do in the classroom, but kind of a package of training. But they are disadvantaged, and they're actually cruelly disadvantaged by the underlying geography of the networks. And so, now, that's one problem, but another problem is that everybody can't go to university, right? We've been, basically, the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, especially here in the European Union, has been an emphasis on raising the rate of university graduates. And that's probably not a bad thing. It's part of general social modernization. But I think most people are now beginning to think that we've probably gotten to the point where there's probably a natural ceiling on how many people are going to get university diplomas. There's a natural ceiling on who are going to get really good ones and get into the right networks. Right? As I said, because they're not all worth the same thing. And so there's some kind of new issue here, which is an intermixing of the nature of skills, but also their geography and the geography of networks. And there's also, I think, a parallel failure to train sensibly to middle-skilled service and production jobs, both both here in places like London, but also in outlying regions. There's what we might call, and nowhere more so than Britain, a really big skills gap, okay? Kind of a gap between what we need to be training for and what we are. So we need to rethink of this, and what I'm sort of saying though is here is that it's not just training in general, there's a geographical component to the mix of what you can skill to and what you should skill to in different regions. Training, of course, isn't enough. That's the other part of this policy debate. Policy debate is basically about, in the first place, it's housing. In the second place, it's this kind of supply side, let's skill everybody up, right? And those are nice, happy stories because they're kind of easy to imagine, right? Of course we should not allow the NIMBYs to dominate the world and restrict access, and of course everyone should get skilled. But a thornier problem, actually, is the underlying geography and nature of job creation in this world, which is that we are just not creating very many jobs, and we're certainly not creating very good jobs outside of a selected set of metropolitan areas. Where will the good jobs come from in these areas? The forces of globalization and technological change, they combine to put these regions in something like a vice grip, or something like what in economics we would call a trap. Okay, and the trap is that, on the one hand, they're too expensive to compete with cheaper countries. Right? So for sort of middle and lower skilled functions, basically the developing world is a better location today, especially because transport costs just are going down and down, making those areas competitive. But these regions in the developed countries are not innovative or skilled enough to compete with the big cities that have all of those agglomeration economies and networks. Or they're not, and they're also maybe not innovative enough to compete with technologically endowed specialized regions. So the big city's case here is London. The specialized region would be the Cambridges of the developed world, right? And of course, companies, they just have less, let's be honest about it, and it's not even a moral critique, it's just a statement. They have less loyalty to regions than in the past because the world is an open kind of locational set of choices for them. So a major challenge for the developed world is how to overcome the middle income trap for an increasing number of our regions. That's a lot of England. It's a lot of the, we might say, the non-northeast coast or west coast of America is in this economic middle income trap. So again, to reinforce my point, yes, there's a housing element. Yes, there's a skills element. But the hardcore, really complicated policy problem is, what are we going to do to create jobs for these places when the basic logic of the contemporary economy is not in their favor? Right, that's my negative point for today. Okay, but I want to add one other thing. I want to add actually kind of another layer to this emerging puzzle of divergence, which is it's not just about these hard economic forces of agglomeration economies and networks and skills and so on. It's that I think many scholars are quite surprised that certain kinds of attitudes and values seem to be diverging between regions within countries. So we know, for example, that when we do opinion polls and sociological research, and we separate the population roughly into people who do manual kinds of work and people who do cognitive kinds of work, that there's a really strong correlation to the kinds of social values and outlook on the future that they have. So there's a kind of an emerging discussion in many countries, which is about why the professional, sort of, in America you call them upper middle class, you call them professional people in many other countries, or we call them now the new urban elites, and the manual working classes, they don't seem to understand each other very much anymore, right? Maybe they never did entirely, but certainly it seemed like there were periods when everyone seemed to sort of be in on the idea of a kind of mutually favorable synergy or deal. I'm not, by the way, trying to elide the history of class conflict in major democracies. That too. But certainly there's something going on today. And there's for example, a new term in America that people use, which is the politics of resentment. Politics of resentment in these regions that are less successful. And it seems like what we're seeing the emerging of is new ways of life and experiences on the ground, when you actually talk to people and say, well, what do you do during the day, right? What kinds of people do you interact with? What kinds of things do you think about? What newspapers do you read? What social media do you consult? What are your ties and your networks? You actually come up with this picture of people living very different kinds of lives. And I'm talking about within Britain, not between, you know, Britain and Nigeria, right? And we used to think about, you know, different levels of development. But in fact, within the developed countries, we're seeing this emergence of different ways of life. And we could say that there are almost like different senses of validation, honor, and self-worth that seem to be emerging in different parts of our societies, but that have a strong geographical expression. That can also be true between neighborhoods, right? Or even, you know, between you and your next door neighbors in a cosmopolitan city like London. But we're talking about sort of broad tendencies that have a geography. So these now these aren't just, I think, interesting sort of extra characteristics of the divergence. It's that many scholars believe that these cultural and institutional dimensions have feedbacks to economic variables, such as how people make educational choices, how they have mobility choices, and how they respond to incentives. So one thing we know in the case of the American evidence is that if you control for what we call people's different characteristics, like, you know, what did your parents do, and what is your family income, and all those kinds of things. So you take, in principle, two people who are similar as persons, and you put them in different regions, that the way they respond to educational opportunities is now really different. Meaning that something's going on probably in their local culture or their local interaction. They're seeing the future in different ways. And again, most social scientists, we didn't think that would happen. We thought it would be going in the opposite direction. It goes against modernization theory. So the point is that we're back to a world where we really need to understand the contexts of different regions as hard economic systems, but also as systems of values and attitudes. And these things are coming together. And of course, we know that this emerges really clearly in attitudes toward immigrants, toward the outside world. This has now become a standard thing to observe since Brexit and Trump and Le Pen and so on, which is we've got these cosmopolitan big cities where where without, again, effacing any of the kind of rough and tumble, rough edges of our multi-ethnic cities, they're not paradise, right? And they're certainly not paradise for everyone. But by and large, there's a kind of, we've kind of integrated this idea that, you know, we are multicultural places and we sort of like it, right? And it kind of works for us. And it works in economic terms because there's a complementarity of the immigrants and the skilled. That's that core economy and the very dynamic residential economy. But elsewhere, what we see are nationalism and roots on the rise. And of course, that corresponds to the fact that there's actually local labor market competition in these other areas. Right? They don't have the same kinds of economic circuits. That's part of the divergence. And of course, the other thing is that they have different institutions. In cities, for the last 30 years, we have this very complex web of things like neighborhood organizations and various kinds of NGOs and various kinds of sort of civic tissue that's emerged that have kind of, you know, made us think about what does it mean, you know, being in London is kind of being multicultural, and what's that all about, and giving up our cultural assumptions and learning from others. And we can measure that in economics, that the learning from diversity has actual economic returns in places where you have high levels of diversity, but it has lower returns in places where natives compete with immigrants. So there's all kinds of dimensions of this. And of course, now we know that this totals up to a real problem, which is social and spatial traps. There are a lot of regions in our developed countries that have social feedbacks like very high rates of depression, very high rates of drug use and alcoholism. Of course, in America, there's the opioid crisis, which is absolutely massive. Low rates of school performance, lower intergenerational social mobility, insufficient productivity that comes from that. You know, those things, they're human problems, but they're really not great for economics, right? They lower productivity, they lead to declining lifespans, they lead to declining labor force participation. So we are now in a world where instead of this fluidity of opportunity, people flowing to opportunity and jobs diffusing to people, we're now in a world of increasing spatial poverty traps at a large scale. Okay, so how many more minutes do I have? Okay. So what I want to do now is, in having given you this picture, which I hope doesn't sound overly negative, but I think it's a serious challenge for us, is I want to talk about what we need to think about, both from my world, which is the research world, but I think also connecting to the policy world. And the starting point I have is that, I want to sort of be as clear as possible about this, there is one kind of worldview, at least in both in policy and in research, which says we should just let cities rip, meaning that we should make sure that we dismantle the barriers to mobility, and if all the prosperity flows to big cities, that's great. And in a way, that will ultimately somehow magically transform the suffering regions, because they'll basically have outflow of population, and at some point that'll turn them around because they won't have so many people to take care of. I don't really think that's what's happening. I think because, as I said, the plumbing is kind of is stopped, right, on these mechanisms of sharing prosperity. So we really have to figure out how to share the prosperity between the regions. And so there's a bunch of different questions or priorities that emerge from that. So first, we really do need to think about migrating up to opportunity. I don't think, as I've mentioned a few minutes ago, that the only barrier is housing. We obviously do need to do something about whatever we can to reduce housing costs. But I think the real core of this effort in getting mobility and migration going again is to rethink skills, rethink what we mean by training, and figure out how to share the right kind of new economy training with people who don't happen to be in places like London or Cambridge. That's a problem that we really have not identified clearly in policy terms, and I think in the education part of this puzzle, we need to do so. A second is the one I mentioned a few minutes ago, which is spreading jobs to middle-income regions. Right now, you know, we have a kind of a standard framework which is full of, you know, politically correct things that everybody agrees with. You can possibly disagree with them. Let's do entrepreneurship. Let's have university partnerships. Let's have clusters everywhere, tax breaks. Let's do logistics and infrastructure. I mean, any of you who are in the policy business, you kind of know that there's this kind of package we all are sort of consensual about. These things are not useless, but they're not working. So the hard question we have to ask is, why aren't they working? And I think probably the only way I can think of into this at the moment, because we've studied each of these things separately. There's a huge literature on entrepreneurship, a huge literature on clusters, huge literature on every one of these different things. It's how they come together that we don't really master that subject. And what I would like to do, if I were in, you know, my sort of perfect world, is I'd want to study all of the successful places and figure out what they have in common. And I'd also want to study a parallel set of unsuccessful places. And especially, I think the circumstances are such that we have to, this is easier said than done, really avoid trendy, wishful, pop thinking about regional development. There's a huge amount of this, to be honest. It sucks up a lot of time. It sounds good. You know, every region will be successful. Every region will be environmental, sustainable. It will be, you know, socially inclusive. And there's all these terms, and frankly, I'm kind of sick of them, right? Because I don't think they have really strong analytical content. I'm not accusing the people who do this. I do some of this, right? But we have to really, I think, take the measure of the seriousness of the divergence going on. Social factors, now this is easy, and I think consensual, which is any program that tries to spread prosperity has to deal with these accumulating negative social externalities. That's schooling, health, behavior, despair. There's of course a chicken and egg interaction, but what we know is that if the social fabric deteriorates, people are not in a position to be productive, no matter what you bring to them, right? If it goes beyond a certain point. And we are seeing that in certain regions of many developed countries, which is surprising. So social and behavioral support really can't be sidelined. It's not only humanly correct, but it's an economic necessity. And it might only be a Band-Aid, but it's a Band-Aid we need to do to stop the hemorrhaging at this moment. I think another is, and this kind of goes back to an earlier point, but maybe taking an even longer term perspective, which is there's a history to these kinds of things. The economy goes through cycles, and it tends to support certain places over a relatively long run, and it tends to give other places, we might say, blips of prosperity that are kind of evanescent and disappear. And actually, you know, wonderful research done by Center for Cities, and it report on a century of British cities, shows that some British cities have been able to reinvent themselves. And others have tended to kind of dig in and try to do what they did in previous economic cycles. So that's a kind of long-term perspective that we need, and we see it in many countries. In America, there's a kind of a set of comeback cities. Boston was actually in really bad shape in the 1960s and 1970s. So was New York. Why did they come back, but Chicago, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, St. Louis, and Detroit didn't? So it's got to be something about long-term, over many cycles, resilience that we need to know more about. Another point which I touched on is, why is the divergence so strong this time? So we have, again, in the past, we know that with every new economy, there's a bunch of agglomerations that are kind of like the technological and entrepreneurial winners of their time, right? Manchester was the Silicon Valley of the 19th century. It's not the Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley's the Silicon Valley today, right? But the point is that with each cycle, there's usually sort of like a time period. It usually lasts for 30, 40 years, and then what happens is, as the technologies mature, the benefits start to flow outward in a process where industries relocate, and there's what's called technological spillovers and diffusion. We aren't seeing them yet, and yet we're actually at 45, almost 50 years into this transition, and the concentration economies continue to rip. So we really need to know, what is it about this wave of change that is so strongly urban and so strongly dominated by a small number of metropolitan areas? And then let's not forget the problems of prosperous places. All is not perfect, even in London. The main problem of prosperous places is housing. Now you might say, but wait a minute, you told me housing wasn't important. Housing, I do not believe, is the problem at an inter-regional scale. It's not the tail wagging the dog of inter-regional divergence. That was the case I made. But it is a problem internal to every prosperous metropolitan area. Something, we know this, right? We are successful in solving many problems. We know how to build new, I mean, it takes a while, but we can improve the transport system. We're making places like London and Paris and New York just much more amenity rich, right? There's parks and museums and all kinds of wonderful nightlife and great restaurants and all these fabulous things. Why can't we solve the housing problem? why is it that housing is just this continual sort of aggravating, conflict generating, and also injustice generating a problem with gentrification, with substandard housing, and so on. So there's a worldwide phenomenon of gentrification and massive landowner profits right now, right? And now, remember, that wasn't the case. A few decades ago, that's not what we were worried about in places like Boston or New York or London. We were worried about urban decrepitude, right, and degradation. So it's striking that actually, with all of our scientific knowledge, we haven't solved the housing problem. And I think actually that we're kind of polarized. You've got on the one side, deregulate and construct. That's, I would say, the mainstream of the economics profession, right? The problem is regulation, NIMBYs, you know, stultifying bureaucracy and all that. And then you've got this other kind of what I would call sort of social justice brigade on the other side, which says regulate and construct and publicly own. But I believe from, I'm not a housing specialist, but I don't think either of them is right. I think there's kind of like you've got like a debate between fundamentalisms, and what we need is to really think about housing as a very complex field of economics and practice and figure out if there are any practical solutions to what is a nagging problem with every major prosperous metropolitan area today. I would say, however, one thing is that all upgrading is not gentrification. This is one of my pet peeves. You know, Ruth Glass invented this term when she saw the middle class come back to London in the 1950s. And remember, cities are naturally changing ecosystems, right? So, yes, it sort of looks like gentrification if you have a working class neighborhood and all these professionals move into it. But remember, you can't benchmark it against the economy that existed when that neighborhood became working class. Right? That's the past economy. You have to benchmark it against the economy today. So we have to have some kind of way of not just saying all change is gentrification. A lot of change is good. You know why? Because it's called development. It's because the economy is becoming richer and more people are becoming professional. So you would expect that to be expressed in the city. So in fact, a professional relative to the economy today is not so distant from the real people as a professional was 100 years ago when a lot of these neighborhoods got their initial character. So we have to really rethink and not use this term indiscriminately. And then the last thing, so this is the last thought, which is, what if all of the other things I'm talking about need to be put in the context of the party almost being over for big prosperous cities? I'm worried less about congestion, externalities, and housing prices, and more about the natural tendency of capitalism to be extremely dynamic, to reinvent itself. And that means reinvent new industries and ways of life that might go to new places. I said a few minutes ago, it doesn't seem like this wave of change is over, but that's usually in economic history. Just as people think everything is one way, that's when you get sideswiped by major change. So waves of technological change can happen. Is the party over? What are things like artificial intelligence and machine learning and blockchains and all these other things that are really right around the corner? What are they going to do to the skilled cognitive jobs that the mainstays of places like London today? It might reduce the number of skilled people required, and they might reduce the premiums we pay them, and that would be a double hit for us, right? Because here in London, what makes London rich is that there's a lot of these skilled people and they get paid a lot of money. What if technology is about to undermine all that? So what do we need to do to prepare for this eventuality? We really need to think about what is coming, and not in a kind of, you know, that kind of industry of futurists, right, who always write those books with, you know, telling us that everything is about to change, but really have a kind of a realistic assessment of our labor markets and housing markets and the geography of all of that. So those are my my priorities. I think we need to, as you can see, the agenda for thinking about cities and regions, the current dilemmas, but also the what that means for policy are rich, they're exciting, but we live in a challenging world, and I do think that the real challenge is to think about this underlying divergence or separate worlds that I've tried to describe to you here today. So thank you very much for listening.
So what we'll do, in about 15 minutes or so, we'll take some questions from the floor. The usual way, we've got a couple of roving mics. You just hold up your hand if you want to ask a question. If you make it look nice and short and sharp, then we can get Michael to answer short and sharp as well. We get through a couple of rounds. I'll take two or three anyone goes, so we can just scribble them down. I've got one at the front, Lynn. The gentleman at the back there. Just keep your hand in the air until the mic gets to you. One there, and he's there. Then you go first.
Hi, thanks for that. I think that you were saying that from a national spatial point of view, the main challenge is not housing, but it's how do we spread jobs. And I think you said that what we're doing is generally not enough, not that it's necessarily not working, and that you said on your slides nothing should be off the table. And you didn't really touch on that. I wondered what you thought was off the table currently that ought to be back on it.
Good. Hold that thought. Gentleman there. One more. I like threes. One gentleman there, yeah.
So
you are?
Yes, Emil Evenhouse, the University of Cambridge. I just wondered what your analysis means for the governance of cities and regions, and especially for the relationship between cities and the nation state.
Governance, cities, and
regions. I'm very impressed by your analysis, which looked at the major cities and the poverty, etc., outside those. But actually, in most of our large cities, and I think probably in the States as well, you still have large amounts of poverty. You've got that divergence within cities. Is that different to the divergence within the country?
Okay, so, jobs we need to do more. What's off the table that we should bring back onto the table in terms of jobs? Question there about issues around governance, particularly, I think, any thoughts on how cities relate to the national state? And then questions about actually when we look at our cities, we see greater divergence often within them than we do necessarily between them. Michael.
So I'll be really candid about the off the table, on the table in terms of job creation outside of the major cities. I don't think we know very much about that at the moment. As I said, we've had a lot of we might say, feel-good formulas. Of course we should promote entrepreneurship. Of course people need skills. One of the biggest mistakes we made was being naive about connectivity, right? Give infrastructure, and somehow that spreads. Well, actually, infrastructure often concentrates. We have a wonderful high-speed train network in France. Guess what it did? It advantaged Paris. There's a whole bunch of things there. I really think we need a fresh look, and we have to look. And my instinct about it, but I can't prove it to you, is that the difference between successful places and less successful ones has to do more with institutions than with any single hard factor. Meaning, is there some kind of network of people and organizations in a region that draws the region together and gives it a narrative about its future? And orients all of the different actors toward lining up toward that future, as opposed to a backward-looking one. So, with a team, we did a book that sort of compared LA and San Francisco, and where San Francisco is kind of the winner in the technology lottery, and we made that kind of argument in just this sort of two-case comparison. But I think it's something we should look into. Okay, governance. I think the question of how cities relate to the national economy and national governance, which is, I think, what you were getting at, is different, of course, in every country, depending on what kind of system it has. If we take countries like Britain or, say, France, where you have these supernovas, respectively London and Paris, and which tend to have this predominant role in almost every network in the country, that presents one set of challenges. If you have federalist countries like, say, the US or Germany or Italy, where there's a more decentralized urban system, there's probably another set of urban policy challenges. Right? One of them, I think, is about super dominance, and what do we do about that? But I will say, I'm definitely not in favor of the sort of tropes of anti-London, anti-Paris. I mean, we've lived through that in France. It never did. It never had any positive effect on the country. So the issue is not turning it into kind of a win, sort of a win-lose thing of if we could just break London, somehow the rest of Britain would become more prosperous. That's really not, that's, I don't believe that's the case. Although there may need to be adjustments in governance, you know, fiscal policy, infrastructure policy, a whole bunch of other things. But particularly, what I think there need to be, if I think I know more about the French case than the British, I know what we need is we need to construct networks of people and firms that are genuinely independent of Paris, right? And that's not a single policy. It's a deep cultural and institutional change that needs to happen so that, as it were, the provinces can live. And then I think your point about inequality within cities is of course, absolutely right. But there's a crucial difference between the poverty within major metropolitan areas and these other parts of many countries. And again, I don't want to be taken to be some kind of apologist for the extreme inequalities that exist within places like London. But when we look at the trajectories of people over time in places like London, at any given moment, the snapshot looks very unequal, right? We have immense differences in income and privilege and housing and all that. But London, in spite of all of that, just like all of its major world counterparts, continues to function as a decent, if flawed, opportunity machine. Flawed. A lot needs to be done, especially with education and housing and all kinds of other things. But there's a real difference to what's going on in these other regions, where the machine of intergenerational social mobility has stalled out. So that's the research of people like Raj Chetty that shows very clearly that big cities are highly unequal, but they have a lot of social mobility over generations. Other places are actually more equal, but have less mobility. So we've got to really think about those and have policies that are adapted to the different geographical contexts, where poverty is important in both.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Let's take a couple more questions. One at the back there, right in the back, Anthony. One right in the back there.
There's one more, and I've got one here as well. So Anthony, when you're done there, you're going to come here, okay? So yeah, just say who you are.
Hi, I'm Isabel. Thank you very much for the talk. I just wanted to ask, why do you think that developers, when they're looking at developing future cities or areas of future cities, look at either the existing major metropolitan areas like London or New York, or just completely blank desert spaces rather than, say, going to a region that could really use that?
Okay.
Hello, it's Balaj. Thank you for the talk. I would like to ask, how much do you think that the actual kind of power that cities have depends on the people? So I feel that in economics, much of it kind of depends on statistics and how much, you know, certain types of people do this, certain types of people do that. But can we not look at the actual some few individuals who drive cities that maybe don't exist in the regions?
So is your question around whether interests and individuals that we see in places like London that are not present in other cities when we think about other cities in the UK or other cities outside the capital?
Yes, sort of, but also kind of the whole way of looking at history is that you can look at kind of the great man theories, or you can look at the how the social kind of context creates great man.
Yeah, that's a historical question in terms of some of your other reflections as well, which we come to. Damien, gentlemen there.
Good evening, I'm Damien Smith of the Bank for Work and Pensions. You've described a series of new economy firms which have a couple of characteristics to my mind, which is that the total addressable market is like global or near global, that they have increasing returns to scale and very high network effects. Given those factors of the structure of firms and industries, what's the subnational policy levers in terms of a lot of what you've talked about are actually the national level in terms of national urban policy? Are there things that local areas can do themselves to actually place themselves quite well? Or does it have to be part of the everything on the table we were talking about earlier?
Okay, so that's three great questions. So we've got questions around the developer industry and how they respond. Why do they go to some places like London or New York or nowhere at all? Why aren't they attracted to those sort of in-between places where values and prices may well be different? We've got something around the great man theory, which I think is historical, about why maybe in the past we did have some of those networks that seem to be eroded over time. Let's say something about that. And then Damien's question is, when we think about our cities making them more successful, is this really macro or national policy, or is there real stuff that we can be doing at the local or city level? So,
all right, I mean, I think developers, it's pretty clear that they respond to incentives and opportunities. And right now, that's where they happen to be in big cities, because the basic attractive power of big cities creates enormous pressure on the urban land market in big cities and creates huge opportunities and low risk. So in a way, the land development rarely leads. It follows basic economics. So what we've got to do is change the basic economics in order for other cities to become attractive to developers. You can do some incentives. This is actually a really interesting thing. It's a conceit of French urban planning. You have a really strong state, and you go and you incentivize, and you say, build it there. So we do that. You get some pretty stuff. You don't change the fundamental geography of development. The great person theory of history. So I think you're right that cities are human networks, and they concentrate people. But this isn't fixed in time and space forever. There's a kind of there's a legendary thing that happened in the U.S. in 1976, I think, which is that New York, now the glorious, splendid, jewel that it is, it was on the verge of bankruptcy. And remember, New York concentrates many of the most powerful people in America or the world. And what happened was that Washington said to New York, we're not giving you any money. And the tabloid newspaper of New York had a headline about this big, which was, Washington to New York, drop dead. Right? So in other words, having powerful people, it depends actually on how they mobilize themselves as citizens of a city, or whether it's just basically where they live. And that's a question about institutions. And I think the other thing is that we do have a few cases where powerful people became, as it were, the anchor tenants for new networks in places where they really committed themselves to working with their peers and with their communities to try and make their city have resilience or sticking point. So every city needs its Lorenzo de Medicis, you could put it that way. And not just to build museums, but to build civic leadership and capacity. I don't think you can do it on that alone, but I think it helps. We're seeing that.
Local policy. So we talked
about local policy.
Is this really macro national, or can we do stuff at the local level that makes a difference?
So that kind of goes back to that issue of the intersection of national governance and the national political system and cities. And I think each country has an issue of what can the national level do best, and what do you need to do to allow places to somehow develop whatever potential capacities they may have. I'll give you, again, a kind of polar opposite examples, neither of which is Britain. One would be France, where we have this very centralized system, right? And you might say that the good news for localities in France is that they will never become Detroit. We don't allow that to happen, right? There's redistribution of money. We have a political system where mayors are very important in France. We have 36,000 of them. They elect the Senate. So, they can get money if they want it, and they do. And we have, everything's pretty, right? We spend money on infrastructure, schools, it's all centralized. And in a way, to outside, to kind of at the appearance level, it looks pretty good. What it doesn't do is create real local dynamism. And that's where there's a kind of, I think that's kind of the critical issue is, and we've had this debate, right, about decentralization. My colleagues at LSE have done a lot of research on this, trying to figure out what kind of decentralization is good in the sense that it allows localities to, I'll use an overused word, to be creative, to stimulate in a good way, and even allows them to compete in a good way, versus the kind of decentralization that is kind of just a race to the bottom and everyone going to the... And I think getting that one right is a really critical thing. But for each country, it's a slightly different issue. In the U.S., I think we're in this kind of free-for-all of competition, and there's basically no floor. So France and the U.S. are exact opposites. But I think each country, we do have to solve this one in the current ever. And the key question for the places that are out there is, what do we need to do at the national level to support them, give them resources, make sure they don't fall, and at the same time, give them some degree of autonomy in figuring out what the pathway is for each city and region, because it's not going to be the same.
We're nearly out of time, so I'm going to use my chairing role to ask the last question, get a thought from you. You talked a little bit at the beginning, I think, Michael, about how the economics and the social are connected to the politics. We see a divergence of politics and political outcome. When we think about these questions about divergence between localities within nations, does that sort of political geography make it more difficult to deal with these questions or easier?
I think at the moment it's making it more difficult. And this is worrying, and it's surprising to many of us, because we had a theory about, you know, we live in the internet age and we all watch the same television programs and we're supposed to be globally connected and, you know, just anywhere we have access to the same information. And it turns out not to be the case. That it actually, we don't have the same socialization processes going on. And I think we can see it in politics now, that the debates and some of the conflicts have become really, really acrid, really surprisingly strong and bitter. And in almost every country now, you have the reemergence of this, of books, you know, where people say, you know, the elitists in New York, they look down on us, or vice versa, right? The people in New York or London, sort of like, you know, who are all these hicks and rednecks and people who, you know, and they're racist and they're sexist and they're terrible. And surprising degree of cultural conflict that we are experiencing, which is not entirely due to geography. It has to do with, geography is just one force among others. I'm a geographer, I think it's really important. But the point is that it's actually become, I think, a real element in the social and political dramas of our countries these days. So I don't think we're in a period where it's getting better, and that's why it's urgent to start thinking about it.
Great. John, I'm really thank you, Michael. I'll stop up.